off. She took him by the arm. "They've seen something ahead," she said, eyes bright with dread or excitement. "The lookouts." "What sort of something?" "Land." Nicolay stared in disbelief. Breathless, he followed her to the prow of the ship, where the Golden Empress stood with Padar.
"You are in luck, Ruse," the former said.
She handed him her nightglass. Nicolay squinted into it. An island, unquestionably. A small one. Almost certainly uninhabited, but an island nonetheless. He breathed out as he handed the nightglass back.
"I'm glad to see it, all-honored Golden Empress," he said, frankly.
She beheld the island with a hunter's intent. As she turned to one of her officers, Nicolay glanced at the notches on her wooden arm.
"She is signalling to the Black Dove to circle the island," Leia murmured. "The High Sea Guard could still be on our tail, or rumours could have reached another pirate ship of our quest."
"Surely no pirate captain would be fool enough to confront a ship like this."
"The world is full of fools, Nicolay, and they are never more foolish than when they smell eternal life."
Sabran could attest to that. So could Janart. Nicolay tapped his finger on the gunwale. As the island came closer, his mouth turned dry as ashes.
"Come, Ruse," the Golden Empress said. Her voice was velvet soft. "You ought to share in the first spoils. After all, you brought us here."
He dared not argue. When they were anchored, the Golden Empress addressed her pirates. This island, she told them, was home to a bounty that would lay waste to their troubles. The elixir would make them all powerful. They would be masters of the sea. Her people roared and stamped their feet until Nicolay's was brittle with fear. They might be triumphant now, but one sniff of failure, one whisper that they had come all this way for nothing, and their joy would turn to murderous ire. A boat was readied for the scouting party. Leia and Nicolay joined the 20 members of the crew, including the Golden Empress, who would set foot on the island before anyone else, and Gonra, her heir, though Nicolay supposed she would never need an heir if they did find the elixir. The rowing boat glided out of the shadow of the pursuit. It soon became apparent to Nicolay that what they could see of the island was only the pinnacle of it. Much of the rest had been claimed by the sea. When they could go no farther, they left two of their number with the boat and waded the rest of the way. Nicolay stepped onto dry land and wrung the water from his shirt. This place might be his grave. He had imagined being folded into the dirt of Orisima. Instead, his bones would lie on a hidden island in the vastness of a far-off sea. Drunkenness made him slow. When Gonra looked over her shoulder and arched an eyebrow at him, he took a deep breath and trudged after her, up a hummock of slippery rock. Their footsteps took them into the darkness of a forest. The only hint of civilization was the stone bridge they used to cross a stream. He made out a flight of steps, scarped into the rock. The Golden Empress was the first to mount it. They climbed the stair for what seemed like hours. It snaked between endless maple and fir trees. There were no dwellings here, no guardians of the mulberry tree, just nature, given leave to run its course for centuries. Wasps droned and birds chirruped. A hart bounded across their path and back into the gloaming, startling half the pirates into drawing their swords. Nicolay panted. Sweat drenched his shirt. He mopped his brow, fruitlessly, as rivulets trickled down his brow. It had been a long time since he had exerted himself like this. "Nicolay," Leia said under her breath, "are you all right?"
"Dying," he gritted out. "By the grace of the damsel, I'll expire before we reach the top."
He only realized they had stopped when he walked headlong into Gonra, who knocked him back with a pointy elbow to the gut. Legs trembling, Nicolay looked up to behold a tree. A gnarled and ancient mulberry, larger than any tree he had ever laid eyes on. Cut down. Nicolay stared at the fallen giant. The feeling bled from his legs. His lips began to shake, and his eyes grew hot. He was here, at the end of the way of the outcasts. This was what Janart wanted to see, the secret he had died for. Nicolay was standing in the realization of his dream. His faithless dream. The mulberry tree bore no flower or fruit. It looked almost grotesque in its mass, stretched beyond its natural proportions, like a body pulled upon a rack. Its trunk was as thick as a baleen. In death, its branches reached for the stars, as if they might hold out silver hands and help it stand again. The Golden Empress walked slowly among the dead limbs. Leia took Nicolay by the arm. He felt her shivering,
and felt himself pressing his hands over hers.
Yadaje,
Ruse, the Golden Empress called. Come here. Leia closed her eyes.
It's all right. Nicolaes kept his voice low. She won't hurt you, Leia. You're too useful to her.
I have no wish to watch her hurt you.
I'm deeply hurt by how little faith you have in my capacity for battle, Mistress Yadaje.
He held up his cane with a weak smile.
I can take them all with this, don't you think?
She choked back a laugh.
There are words carved here, the Golden Empress said to Leia when they were near. Translate them?
Her face betrayed nothing. Leia let go of Nicolaes and stepped over a branch and crouched beside the trunk. One of the pirates handed her a torch, and she held it carefully towards the tree. The flames shed light on a cascade of carved words.
Forgive me, all-honoured Golden Empress, but I cannot translate this. Bits of it are familiar, but much of it is not, Leia said. I fear it is beyond the realm of my knowledge.
Perhaps I can.
Nicolaes glanced over his shoulder. The Cyclonese scholar, the one who was never far from the Golden Empress, laid a withered hand on the trunk as if it were the earthly remains of an old friend.
The torch, if you please, he said. This will not take long.
There was no moonlight to betray the western ship. From high in its yards, Tane watched the pirates go ashore. The Rose Eternal was anchored where the pirates could not see. After she had turned the ship southeast at the right moment, they had sailed until her nightglass revealed an island. Eldevara believed the rising jewel had come from here. Perhaps this place held the secret of why it had been in her side, or perhaps not. What mattered was Nyamathan. The wind blew strands of hair across her face. She knew these ships from her days in the South House, where she had learned to identify the most notorious vessels in the fleet of the Tigerai. Both carried the red sails of sickness. The Black Dove, which was half the length of the Pursuit, was circling the island with its gun ports open. Tane descended to the deck. She had freed her two captives so they might help her.
You, Tane said to Thym, while I am gone, guard the ship.
Thym watched her.
Where are you going?
To the Pursuit.
They will tear you apart.
Help me survive, and I will see to it that you get to the Empire of the 12 Lakes in one piece. Betray me, and I will leave you here to die, Tane said.
The choice is yours.
Who are you? Thym asked, frowning. You fight better than any soldier. None of the crew stood a chance against you. Why were you drafted into the ranks of the scholars and not the Medushi?
Tane handed him the nightglass.
If they see you, was all that she said, fire one of the cannons as a warning.
But Thym had realized. She watched the deference rise into his eyes.
You were Medushi. Thym studied her face. Why were you banished? Who I am and who I was are none of your concern. She nodded to Loth. You, come with me.
Into the sea. Loth stared at her.
We'll freeze.
Not if we keep moving.
What do you mean to do on that ship?
Free a prisoner. Tane braced herself before she climbed down the side of the ship, shivering in the chill. Then she let go. Her body plunged into darkness. The cold knocked the breath from her, bubbles exploding from her lips. It was worse than she had expected. She had swum every day in Psyche, whatever the season, but the Sundance Sea had never been this frigid. When she surfaced, her breath came in white puffs. Behind her, Loth made wordless sounds of discomfort. He was at the bottom of the slats.
Just jump, Tane forced out. It will be over soon.
Loth squeezed his eyes shut, and his face took on a forbearance of a man who had consigned himself to death before he let go. He sank and surfaced in an instant, gasping.
Saint, his teeth chattered. It's freezing.
Then you will need to hurry, Tane said, and swam. The lanterns on the Pursuit were extinguished. The ship was so tall that Tane had little fear of the lookouts. They would never see two heads in the dark water. After all, these 9-masted treasure galleons were larger than any other ship in the world, more than large enough to hold a dragon. Movement was difficult. The cold stiffened her joints. Tane sucked in a breath and went below the waves again. When she came up beside the Pursuit, Loth was close behind, shivering uncontrollably. She had meant to crawl in through the gun ports, but they were closed, and there were no obvious handholds. The anchor. It was the only link between the water and the deck. She swam beside the hull until she reached the stern. Salt water mingled with sweat as she lifted herself from the sea and climbed. She could hear Loth struggling up behind her. Every inch of progress felt hard won. Each limb was fighting to remember its strength. Close to the top, she lost her grip. It happened too fast for her to so much as take a breath, let alone scream. One moment she was rising, the next falling. Then she hit something warm and solid. She looked down to see Loth below her. Her foot had landed on his shoulder. She could tell he was straining to hold them both up, but he smiled. Tanny looked away and kept climbing. Her arms were trembling by the time she reached the defaced carving of the great imperial dragon at the stern of the ship. She climbed around it, pulled herself over the side, and landed, light-footed, on the deck. The Golden Empress would be on the island, but she would have left guards behind. Keeping low, Tanne wrung the icy water from her tunic. Loth fell into a crouch beside her. She could just make out the silhouettes of the hundreds of pirates left on board. The Pursuit was a lawless city on the sea. Like all pirate ships, it absorbed miscreants from many parts of the world. In this darkness, provided no one stopped them, they might be able to blend in. Three flights of steps would take them to the lowest deck on the ship. She straightened and walked out from their hiding place. Loth followed her, keeping his head down. Pirates surrounded them. Tanne could hardly see any of their faces. She heard strains of their conversations.
"Gut the old man if he's betrayed us. He's no fool. What purpose would there be in? He's mentish. The Cyconese would have kept him cooped up like a songbird in Orissima," a woman said. "Perhaps he would take death over imprisonment, like the rest of us."
Ruse. There were no other ment they could be talking about. Her fingertips grew hot. She itched to wrap her hands around his throat. It was not Ruse's fault that she had been sent to Feather Island. She alone was to blame for that. Yet he had blackmailed her. He had dared to ask her to hurt Nyimathun. Now he was abetting the pirates who took and slaughtered dragons. For all those things, he deserved death. She tried to quash the desire for it. There could be no distractions here. They slipped into the stairway that would take them to the hull. At the bottom, one lantern flickered. Its flame revealed two scarred pirates, both armed with pistols and swords. Tanne walked towards them.
"Who goes there?" one of them asked roughly.
One shout would draw a throng of pirates from above. She would have to kill them, and in silence. Like water. Her knife slid through the shadows, straight into a beating heart. Before the other guard could react, she had slit his throat. The look in his eyes was like nothing Tanne had ever seen. The shock, the realization of his mortality, the reduction of his being to the wetness at his neck. A wordless sound came bubbling from his lips, and he crumpled at her feet. The taste of iron filled her mouth. She watched the blood throb out of him, black in the lantern light.
"Tanne," Loth said.
Her skin was as chill as the sword in her hand.
"Tanne," his voice was hoarse. "Please, we must hurry."
Two corpses lay before her. Her stomach roiled, and blackness hit her like a cloud of flies. She had killed. Not the way she had killed Sousa. This time she had taken life with her own hand. Dizzy, she raised her head. Loth removed the lantern that hung above the bodies and held it out to her. She took it, hand unsteady, and walked into the innards of the ship. She could ask forgiveness from the Great Quirrici in good time. For now, she must find Nyimathun. At first, all she could see were supplies. Barrels of water, sacks of rice and millet, chests that must be filled with plunder. When she caught a glimpse of green, she let out a breath.
Nyimathun. She was still breathing.
Chains held her down and a wound had festered where scale had been torn from her flesh, but she was breathing. Loth drew a sign on his chest. He looked as if he had seen his own doom. Tanne sank to her knees before the god who had once been her kin, abandoning her sword and lantern.
Nyimathun.
No answer. Tanne tried to swallow the thickness in her throat. Her eyes brimmed as she took in the damage the chains had wreaked. A tear ran to her jaw. She boiled with loathing. No one with a soul could do this to a living thing. No one with a shred of shame could treat a god this way. Dragons had sacrificed so much to protect the mortals who shared their world. In return, mortals gave only malice and greed. Nyimathun kept breathing. Tanne stroked her hand down her snout, where the scales were as dry as cuttlebone. It was unspeakably cruel of them to have kept her out of water for this long.
"Great Nyamathun," she whispered, "please, it's me. It's Tane. Let me take you home."
One eye peeled open. The blue in it was dim, like the last glow of a long dead star.
"Tane."
She had never truly believed she would hear that voice again.
"Yes."
Another tear dribbled down her cheek.
"Yes, great Nyamathun, I am here."
"You came," Nyamathun said. Her breaths were labored.
"You should not have come."
"I should have come sooner." Tane lowered her head.
"Forgive me for letting them take you."
"Someone took you first," the dragon growled. A tooth was missing from her lower jaw.
"You are hurt."
"This is not my blood." With unsteady hands, Tane opened the case at her hip and fumbled out the jewel.
"I found one of the jewels you spoke about, Nyamathun. It was sewn into my side."
She held it out so the dragon could see it.
"This Westerner claims he knows the one who has its twin."
Nyamathun looked for a long time at the jewel, then at Loth, who was shaken in his boots.
"We can speak of this when we are in a safe place," she said. "But by finding these jewels, you have given us a way to fight the Nameless One. For this, Tane, every dragon that draws breath is in your debt."
A faint light rippled through her scales.
"I am still strong enough to break through the hull, but I must be free. You will need the key to my chains."
"Tell me who has it." The dragon closed her eyes again.
"The Golden Empress," she said.
Chapter 62. East.
The scholar was surrounded by flaming torches. It seemed to Nicolaes as if he had been circling the mulberry tree for hours, reading by firelight. During that time, hardly a word had passed between any of the pirates. When the scholar finally straightened, every head flicked up. The Golden Empress was sitting nearby, sharpening her sword with one hand while her wooden arm weighted it in place. Each rasp of the whetstone down the blade cut Nicolaes to the quick.
"I am finished," the scholar said.
"Good."
The Golden Empress did not deign to look up.
"Tell us what you have learned."
Trying not to breathe too hard, Nicolaes reached into his cloak for his handkerchief and mopped his brow.
"This was written in an ancient script of Psyche," the scholar said. "It tells the story of a woman named Nopuro. She lived over 1,000 years ago on this island, Komoridu."
"We are all eager to hear it," the Golden Empress said.
The scholar glanced up at the mulberry tree. Something about his expression did not sit well with Nicolaes.
"Nopuro lived in the fishing village of Ampiki. She made a paltry living as a pearl diver, but despite her work and that of her parents, her family had so little to live on that on some days they had no choice but to eat leaves and soil from the forest floor."
This was why Nicolaes had never understood Janet's obsession. History was miserable.
"When her younger sister died, Nopuro decided to end the suffering. She would dive for rare golden pearls in the unending sea, where other pearl divers dared not go. The water there was too cold, too rough, but Nopuro saw no other choice. She rowed her little boat out from Ampiki into the open sea. As she dived, a great typhoon blew away her boat, leaving her stranded among the unforgiving waves. Somehow she kept her head above water. With no idea how to read the stars, she could only swim for the brightest in the sky. Finally, she washed up on an island. She found it devoid of human life, but in a clearing, she beheld a mulberry tree of marvelous height. Weak with hunger, she ate of its fruit."
He traced some of the words with one finger.
"Nopuro was drunk on the 1,000-flower wine. In ancient times, this was a poetic description for the elixir of life."
The Golden Empress continued to sharpen her sword.
"Nopuro finally escaped the island and returned home. For 10 years, she tried to lead an ordinary life. She wed a kind painter and had a child with him. But her friends and neighbors noticed that she did not age, did not grow weak or sick. Some called her a goddess, others feared her. Eventually, she left Psyche and returned to Komoridu, where no one could look upon her as an abomination. The burden of immortality was so great that she considered taking her own life, but for her son, she chose to live.
The tree granted her immortality, the Golden Empress said, still wetting the blade. Yet she believed herself able to take her own life.
The tree had granted her protection only from old age. She could still be hurt or killed by other means.
The scholar glanced at the tree.
Over the years, many followed Neporo to her island. Black doves and white crows flew to her, for she was mother to the outcasts.
Leia tightened her grip on Nicolay's, and he tightened his on her.
We should leave, she breathed against his ear. Nicolay's, the tree is dead. There is no elixir.
Nicolay swallowed. The Golden Empress seemed absorbed. He could slip away, unnoticed. And yet he found himself rooted to the spot, unable to stop listening to the story of Neporo.
Wait, he said out of the corner of his mouth. Around the time the Dreadmount erupted, the scholar continued, Neporo received two gifts from a dragon. They were called the Celestial Jewels, and with them, the dragon told Neporo that she would be able to lock the beast of the mountain away for 1,000 years.
Answer me this, Padar cut in. Why did the dragon need to ask a human for help?
The tree does not say, came the calm reply.
Though Neporo was willing to stand, she could only control one of the jewels. She needed someone else to wield the second. That was when a miracle came. A princess of the south arrived on the shores of Komoridu. Her name was Cleolind.
Nicolay's exchanged a stunned glance with Leia. The prayer book said nothing about this.
Cleolind also possessed eternal life. She had vanquished the Nameless One before, but believed his wounds would soon heal. Determined to end him once and for all, she had gone in search of others who might be able to help her. Neporo was her last hope.
The scholar paused to wet his lips.
Cleolind, Princess of Lassia, took up the waning jewel. Neporo, Queen of Komoridu, took up its twin. Together, they sealed the Nameless One in the Abyss, binding him for 1,000 years, but not one sunrise more.
Nicolay's found himself unable to shut his jaw. Because if this tale was true, then the founding legend of the House of Barethnet was nonsense. It was not a line of daughters that kept the Nameless One chained, but two jewels.
Oh, Sabran was going to be most upset.
Cleolind had been weakened by her first encounter with the Nameless One. Facing him a second time destroyed her. Neporo returned the body to the south, along with the waning jewel.
And the other jewel, the rising jewel, the Golden Empress spoke softly. What became of it?
The scholar placed a bony hand on the tree again.
A section of the story is lost, he said.
Nicolay saw that the bark had been viciously hacked.
Fortunately, we can read the end.
And?
It seems that somebody wanted the jewel for themselves. To keep it safe, a descendant of Neporo stitched the rising jewel into his own side, so it might never be taken from him. He left Komoridu and started a humble life in Ampiki, in the same pit house Neporo had once lived in. When he died, it was taken from his body and placed into that of his daughter, and so on. Pause. The jewel lives in a descendant of Neporo.
The Golden Empress looked up from her sword.
Nicolay's listened to his own heartbeat.
This tree is dead, she said, and the jewel is gone. What does this mean for us?
Even if it had not died, it says here that the tree only granted immortality to the very first person who ate of its fruit. After that, it withheld the gift of eternal life, the scholar murmured. I am sorry, all honored one. We are centuries too late. There is nothing on this island but ghosts.
Nicolay's began to feel very sick. The feeling intensified when the Golden Empress rose, her gaze pinned to his face.
All honored captain, he said tremulously. I brought you to the right place, did I not?
She walked towards him, sword held loosely in her hand. He grasped his cane until his knuckles blanched.
Your prize may not be lost. Janart had other books in Mentendon, he pleaded, but his voice was cracking. For the love of the saint, I was not the one who gave you the bloody map in the first place.
Indeed, said the Golden Empress. But it was you who brought me here on this futile pursuit.
No, wait. I can make you an elixir from the dragon's scale. I am sure of it. Let me help you.
She kept coming. That was when Leia seized Nicolaes by the arm. His cane fell as she hauled him into the trees. Her sudden move had taken the pirates by surprise. Ignoring the stairs, she crashed through the undergrowth, dragging Nicolaes with her. Behind them, the scouting party bellowed their fury, terrible as the horn before the hunt.
Leia, Nicolaes gasped out. This is very heroic, but my knees will never outrun a pack of bloodthirsty pirates.
Your knees will manage, Old Red, or you will not have knees, Leia called back. Her voice had a razor edge of panic, but there was laughter there too.
We're going to beat them to the boat. They left guards.
As she dropped to a lower scarp of rock, Leia grasped the dagger in her belt with one hand.
What? She said, extending the other hand to him. Do you think that all this time on pirate ships has taught me nothing about fighting?
Nicolaes hit the ground with knee-jarring force. Leia pulled him down against a tree. They lay still in the hollow of the tree. His knees screamed and his ankle throbbed. Three pirates ran past them. As soon as they had disappeared into the foliage, Leia was on her feet again, helping Nicolaes up.
Stay with me, Old Red. She kept a firm hold of his hand. Come on, we're going home.
Home. They forged on, slithering where the mud was slack and running where they could. Before Nicolaes knew it, the beach was in sight. And there was the rowing boat, with only two guards. They were going to make it. They would row northward until they reached the Empire of the 12 Lakes, and from there they would cast off from the east once and for all. Leia let go of his hand, drew her dagger, and ran across the sand, cloak billowing behind her. She was fast. Before she could strike at the first guard, hands fell upon Nicolaes. The pirates had caught up with them.
Leia!
He shouted, but it was too late. They had her. She cried out as Gonra twisted her arm. Padar forced Nicolaes to his knees.
Padar! Gonra! Leia pleaded. Don't do this! We've known each other so long, please have mercy!
You know us better than that. Gonra wrenched the knife from her hand and held it to her throat.
I gave this blade to you, she bit out, as a kindness, Yadaje. Beg again and it will have your tongue.
Leia clamped her mouth shut. Nicolaes wanted desperately to tell her it was all right, to look away, to say nothing, anything so they might not kill her too. His bladder was threatening to give out. Clenching every muscle in his body, he tried to divorce his mind from his flesh, to float away from himself, into memory. He quaked as the Golden Empress, unperturbed by the fleeting chase, crouched in front of him, and he imagined himself as a notch on her arm. And he realized. He wanted to feel the sun on his face. He wanted to read books and walk through the cobbled streets of Brigstad. He wanted to listen to music, to visit museums and art galleries and theatres, to marvel at the beauty of human creation. He wanted to travel to the south and the north and drink in all they had to offer. He wanted to laugh again. He wanted to live.
I brought my crew over 2 seas, the Golden Empress said to him, so softly only he could hear, for nothing but a story. They will need someone to blame for this disappointment, and I assure you, master of recipes, that it will not be me. Unless you would like Yadaje to take the fall on your behalf, it must be you.
She touched him under the chin with her knife.
They may not kill you, but I think that you will be pleading for that mercy.
Her face blurred. Close by, Gonra gripped Leia by the throat, poised to spill her life.
I can find some means of making it her fault.
The Golden Empress looked at her interpreter, who had sailed with her for decades without remorse.
Lies cost nothing, after all.
Once, Nicolaes had allowed a young musician to be tortured to spare himself the same fate. The act of a man who had forgotten how to serve anyone but himself. If he was to die with any pride, he would not let Leia suffer for him any more than she had already.
You will do no such thing, he said quietly.
Leia shook her head. Her face crumpled into a look of grief.
Take him back to the pursuit and tell the crew what we found.
The Golden Empress rose.
Let us see what they will.
She stopped. Nicolaes looked up. The Golden Empress dropped her blade. A curved sword was across her throat, and Tane Medushi was standing behind her. Nicolaes could hardly believe who he was seeing. He gaped at the woman he had tried to blackmail.
You, he stammered.
Wherever she had been, the last few months had not been kind to her. She was thinner, her eyes smeared with shadow,
fresh blood on her hands. "Give me the key," she said in Lacustrine, her voice deep and thick with hatred. "The keys are the chains." None of the pirates moved. Their captain was just as still, her eyebrows raised. "Now," the dragon rider said, "or your leader dies." Her hand was steady. "The key."
"Somebody give it to her," the Golden Empress said, sounding almost irritated by this interruption. "If she wants her beast, let her take it."
Gonra stepped forward. If her adoptive mother died here, she would be the next Golden Empress. But Nicolaes had sensed a filial loyalty from her. She reached under her collar and held up a bronze key. "No," the dragon rider said, "the key is made of iron." The blade drew blood. "Tick me for a fool again and she dies." Gonra smirked. She produced another key and tossed it.
"For you, dragon lover," she purred. "Best of luck getting back to the ship."
"Let me leave unharmed, and I may not have to use this." The dragon rider threw the Golden Empress aside and held up her free hand. In it was a jewel the size of a walnut, blue as smoke. "Surely not." Nicolaes started to laugh, a climbing, unhinged sort of laugh. "The rising jewel," the scholar breathed, staring. "You. You are the descendant of Noporo." The dragon rider stared back in silence. Tane Madushi, heir of the Queen of Komaridu, heir to an empty rock and a dead tree. It was clear from her expression that she had no idea. Riders were often taken from deprived homes. She must have been separated from her family before they could tell her the truth. "Take my friend with you," Nicolaes said to her suddenly, hot tears of laughter still in his eyes. He nodded to Leia, whose lips were moving in prayer. "I beg you, Lady Tane, she is innocent in all of this." "For you," the dragon rider said with the utmost contempt. "I do nothing."
"And what of me?" the Golden Empress asked. "Do you not wish me dead, rider?"
The younger woman clenched her jaw. Her fingers wrung the hilt of her sword.
"Come, I am old and slow, child. You can put an end to the slaughter of dragons here and now."
The Golden Empress tapped the flat of her own blade against her palm.
"Cut my throat. Earn back your honor."
With a cold smile, the dragon rider closed her fist around the rising jewel. "I will not kill you this night, butcher," she said. "But what you see before you is a ghost. When you least expect it, I will return to haunt you. I will hunt you to the ends of the earth. And I vow to you that if we meet again, I will turn the sea red." She sheathed her sword and walked into the darkness. With her walked the only chance of escape. That was when one of the pirates fired his pistol after her. Tane Madushi stopped. Nicolaes saw her fist tighten around the jewel, and he felt the slightest tremor. A wet roar filled the sky. Leia screamed. Nicolaes barely had time to look up and to stare at the wall of water that was churning up the beach before it swept them all into icy darkness. Nicolaes went head over heels. His nostrils burned as he breathed salt water straight into his chest. Blind with dread, he grappled with the flood, bubbles swarming from his mouth. All he could see was his hands. When he broke the surface, his eyeglasses were lost. From what little he could make out, the pirates had been flung far and wide. The boat that had brought them here was empty, and Tane Madushi had disappeared.
"Find her," the Golden Empress roared.
Nicolaes coughed up water.
"Back to the ship. Bring me that jewel."
The sea withdrew in a rush, as if it sucked into the belly of a god. Nicolaes found himself on all fours on the sand, spluttering, hair dripping into his eyes. A sword lay before him. His hand closed around it. If he could find Leia, they still had a chance. They could fight their way onto the boat and be gone. As he called her name, he became aware of a shadow. He raised a sword, but the Golden Empress knocked it away. A flash of steel, and another. Blood on the sand. A frothing gargle escaped him. He buckled, one hand locked over his throat. The other hand was gone. Somewhere in the chaos, Leia was shouting his name.
"My crew must have flesh."
The Golden Empress scooped up his hand as if it were a dead fish. He retched at the sight of it, still flushed with life, liver-spotted with his years.
"Consider this mercy. I would take the rest of you, but my cargo is in danger, and carrying you would slow us down. You understand, Ruse? You know good business."
Darkness pumped from the screaming mouth of his arm.
The pain was like nothing he had ever felt. Boiling oil, a sun in the stump. He would never hold a quill in this hand again. That was all he could think, even as his lifeblood welled from his throat. Then Leia was at his side, pressing the wound. "Hold on," she said, voice cracking. "Hold on, Nicolas." She gathered him close. "I'm here. I'm going to stay with you. You are going to sleep in Mentendon, not here. Not now, I promise."
A ringing drowned her words. Just before his world turned black, he looked towards the sky and saw at last the form of death. Death, as it turned out, had wings. The pursuit was such an enormous ship that the waves hardly disturbed it. One could almost dream that it was not on water at all. Loth sat in its hull, listening to the commotion on the deck, all too aware that he was deep inside a nest of criminals. He dared not let go of his base lard, but he had doused the lantern, just in case. It was a miracle that no one had come down here yet. Tane had been gone for what felt like an eternity. The worm, no, dragon, observed him with a fearsome blue eye. Loth looked staunchly at the floor. It was true that this creature did not look or act like the draconic beasts of the West, though it was just as large. The horns were not unlike those of a high western, but that was where the similarities ended. A mane like riverweed flowed down its neck. Its face was broad, its eyes round as bucklers, and its scales reminded Loth more of a fish than a lizard. He still had no intention of trusting or talking to it. One glimpse of its teeth, white and razor-sharp, and he knew it was just as capable as Fyodel of tearing him to shreds. Footsteps. He shifted behind a crate and gripped the base lard. His brow was damp. He had never killed, not even the cockatrice. After all this madness, he was somehow free of that stain. But he would. To survive. To save his country. When Tane appeared, her breathing was labored. Her footsteps wove drunkenly and she was soaked to the skin. Without a word, she took a key from her sash and undid the first of the padlocks. Loth helped her heave the chains away. The dragon shook itself and let out a growl. Tane stepped back, motioning for Loth to do the same, as it lifted its head and stretched to its full and formidable length. Loth was only too happy to oblige. For the first time, the beast looked angry. Its nostrils flared, its eyes were on fire. It splayed its toes, found its balance, and, with one great swing, smashed its tail against the side of the ship. The pursuit shuddered. Loth almost lost his footing as the floor quaked beneath him. Shouts came from above. The dragon was panting. If it was too weak to break through, they would all die here. Tane called out to it. Whatever she said, it worked. The dragon steadied itself. Baring its teeth, it slammed its tail again. Wood splintered. Again. A chest slid across the floor. Again. The shouts from the pirates were closer now, their footsteps on the stair. With a snarl, the dragon rammed its body against the hull, gave it a mighty butt with its head, and this time water came roaring in. Tane ran to the dragon and climbed on its back. Mortal sin or certain death. Death was the option the Knight of Courage would have taken, but the Knight of Courage had never needed to get to the Empire of the 12 Lakes as badly as Loth did. Abandoning all hope of Halgallant, Loth waded after the murderous worm lover. Desperately, he tried to climb her beast, but its scales were slick as oil. Tane thrust out a hand. He grasped it, tasting salt, and she hoisted him up. As he looked for something to grip, he fought to blot out the rising dread. He was on a worm. "Thim!" he shouted. "What about Thim?" His words were lost as the dragon clawed from its prison. In panic, Loth grabbed onto Tane, who had lowered her head and grasped the wet mane that surrounded them. With a last push, the dragon writhed through the gaping hole in the pursuit. Loth screamed as they plunged into the sea. A roar in his ears, salt on his lips, a freezing slap of air. Pistols were firing from the decks of the pursuit. The gun ports were opening, and Loth was still astride the dragon. It slithered through the roiling waves, avoiding every shot. Tane gasped desperate-sounding words, hands still wrapped in its mane. It rose like a feather, caught by the wind. Water streamed from its scales as it left the sea behind. Thighs aching with the effort of remaining seated, Loth tightened his arms around Tane and watched the pirates turn to specks. "Saint have mercy," his voice cracked. "Blessed damsel, protect your poor servant." A flare of light made him look west. Now the sails of the Black Dove were on fire, and suddenly worms were flocking, the draconic army. Loth searched the dark, heart booming. There was always a master. The High Western announced its presence with a jet of fire. It winged above the Black Dove and smashed through one of its masts with its tail. Helvisa, the flame of despair. Harlow had said she was near at hand. Her scales, hot as live coals, seemed to drink in the fire that now raged across the fleet. As her followers swarmed over the listing pursuit, she let out a roar that shook Loth to his bones. Tane urged her dragon onwards. The Rose Eternal was in sight. If they descended now, Helvisa would certainly mark them. If they fled, Thim would be on his own. Loth thought his stomach would drop out as their mount arced into a graceful dive. Thim was in the crow's nest. When he saw rescue coming, he scrambled even higher, to the top of the mainmast, and crouched there precariously. As it passed, the dragon scooped him up with its tail. He shouted, legs wheeling, as it yanked him from the Rose Eternal. The dragon was on the rise again, towards a mantle shelf of cloud. It moved through the air as if it was swimming. Thim crawled painfully up its body, using its scales as handholds. When he was near enough, Loth reached out and helped him clamber onto its neck. A shriek raised every hair on his arms. A wyvern was flying after them, spouting flame. The dragon seemed as disturbed by the threat as it would be by a fly. The next jet of flame came so close that Loth smelled brimstone. Thim cocked his pistol and fired at the creature. It screamed but kept coming. Loth squeezed his eyes shut. Either he was going to fall to his death or he was going to be cooked like a goose. Before either thing could happen, a powerful wind came from nowhere, almost unseating them all. The howl of it was deafening. When he could peel one eye open, Loth realized that the dragon was breathing the wind, as draconic things breathed fire. Its eyes glowed welkin blue. Cloud smoked from its nostrils, water beaded on its scales, only to be caught up and scattered like rain. The worm screeched in rage. Its hide steamed and its jaws gaped open, but its flame was quenched, gusted back into its throat, and at last the wind folded its wings and sent it tumbling towards the sea. Rain battered Loth's face. He spat water. Lightning flashed as the dragon entered the clouds, victorious, draping itself in fog as it ascended. That was when Tane keeled to one side. As she fell, some merciful instinct made Loth snap out a hand. His fingers snared the back of her tunic, not a heartbeat too soon. The dragon growled. Breathing hard, Loth scooped Tane close, and Thim hooked an arm around them both. Tane was lifeless, head lolling. Loth checked that the case was still on her sash. If it came undone now, the jewel would be forever lost to the sea. "I hope you know how to talk to dragons," he called to Thim. "Can you tell it where to go?" No reply. When he looked over his shoulder, Loth saw that Thim was staring in wonder at the sky. "I am seated on a god," he said, moonstruck. "I am not worthy of this." At least somebody saw this nightmare as a blessing. Loth steeled himself and addressed the dragon. "Well met, great dragon of the east," he tried, shouting over the wind. "I don't know if you can understand me, but I must speak to the unceasing emperor of the 12 lakes. It is of the utmost importance. Might you be able to take us to this palace?" A rumble went through its body.
"Hold on to Tane," it said in Inish. "And yes, son of the west, I will take you to the city of the 1,000 flowers."
Chapter 63. East. When Tane woke, she found herself looking at a window. The sky beyond was pale as bone ash. She lay in a canopy bed. Someone had dressed her in clean silk, but her skin was gritty with salt. A bowl of embers sat nearby, casting a lambent red glow on the ceiling. When she remembered, her hand flinched to her side. Her sash was gone. Seized by dread, she scrabbled through the quilts, almost scalding herself on a copper bed warmer, only to find her case on a stand beside the bed. The rising jewel glistened inside. Tane sank into the pillows and held the case to her chest. For a long time she remained in bed, imprisoned in a doze. Finally, a woman came into the room. She wore layers of blue and white, and the hem of her skirt touched the floor. "Noble rider," she curtsied to Tane with clasped hands. "This humble one is relieved to find you awake." The room swam. "Where is this?"
This is the city of the Thousand Flowers. You are in the home of His Imperial Majesty, the unceasing Emperor of the Twelve Lakes, who rules beneath the gracious stars. He who is pleased to have you as his guest. The woman replied with a smile. I will bring you something to eat. You have had a long journey.
Wait, please, Tane said, sitting up. Where is Nyimathun?
The shining Nyimathun of the deep snows is resting. As for your friends, they are also guests in the palace.
You must not punish the Westerner for breaching the Seaban. He has knowledge I need.
Neither of your companions have been harmed, the woman said. You are safe here.
She retreated from the room.
Tane took in the ornate ceiling, the nightwood furniture. It was as if she were a rider again. The City of a Thousand Flowers, ancient capital of the Empire of the Twelve Lakes.
Its palace was home not only to the honored unceasing emperor
and the honored Grand Empress Dowager, but to the Imperial Dragon herself. The dragons of Psyche looked to their eldest for guidance, but their lacustrine cousins answered to one ruler. Her thigh was throbbing. She pushed back the sheets and saw that it was bandaged. She remembered the Psychonese man, clad in robes of mulberry red, another scholar who had run from his fate. He had called her the descendant of the long-honored Napuro. Impossible. Surely. Napuro had been a queen. Her descendants could hardly have ended up in a fishing village, scratching out a living in the farthest reaches of Psyche. The servant returned and set down the tray. Red tea, porridge, and boiled eggs with a helping of winter melon. I will have a bath filled for you.
Thank you, Tane said. She picked at the meal while she waited.
The unceasing emperor would not have her as his guest for long when he found out what she was.
A fugitive. A murderer.
Good morning. Thim was in the doorway, clean-shaven, wearing lacustrine clothing. He lowered himself into the chair beside her bed. The servant told me you were awake, he said in Psychonese. His tone was cool. Even if they had worked together on the ship, she had still stolen it from his crew.
As you see, Tane said.
I wanted to thank you, he added with a dip of his head, for saving my life.
It was the great Nyimathun who saved you, Tane put down her teacup.
Where is the Westerner, Honorable Thim?
Lord Ataloth is in the Twilight Gardens. He wants to speak to you.
I will come when I am dressed. She paused before saying, Why did you sail with people from over the abyss?
Thim furrowed his brow.
They are not only raised to hate fire breathers, but our dragons, Tane reminded him. Knowing this, why would you sail with them?
Perhaps you should ask yourself a different question, Honored Medushi, he said. Would the world be any better if we were all the same?
The door closed behind him. Tane reflected on his words and realized that she had no answer. The servant soon returned to take her to the bath. With her assistance, Tane rose from her bed and limped into the next room.
There are clothes in the closet, the servant said. Will you need help to dress, noble rider?
No, thank you. Very well. You are free to explore the palace grounds, though you must not enter the interior court. His Imperial Majesty desires your presence in the Hall of the Fallen Star tomorrow. With that, Tane was alone again. She stood in the shade of the bathing room and listened to the birdsong. The bath was brimful with hot water. Tane slid her robe from her shoulders and unwrapped her thigh. If she craned her neck, she could see the stitches where someone had sealed the bullet graze. She would be fortunate to avoid a fever. Bird skin stippled her arms as she lowered herself into the bath. She sluiced the salt out of her hair, then lay in the water, tired to her bones. She did not deserve to be addressed as a lady or given fine chambers. This peace could not last. When she was clean, Tane dressed. An undershirt and a black silk tunic, then trousers, socks, and snug cloth boots. A sleeveless blue coat, trimmed with fur, came next, and finally, the case on a new sash. Her heart stumbled when she thought of facing Nyimathun. Her dragon had seen the blood on her hands. Someone had left a crutch by the door. Tane took it and stepped out of her bedchamber into a passageway of latticed windows and richly paneled walls. Painted constellations glinted at her from the ceiling. Dark stone paved the floors, heated from beneath. Outside,
she beheld a courtyard of such immensity that it could have housed a shoal of dragons. Lantern light burned through an ashen mist. She could just see the great hall, raised on a terrace of layered marble, each tier a darker shade of blue. "Soldier," Tane said to a guard, "may this humble one ask how you find the Twilight Gardens?"
"Lady," he said, "the Twilight Gardens are in that direction." He motioned to a distant gateway. It took an eternity for her to traverse the courtyard. The Hall of the Fallen Star loomed above her. Tomorrow, she would be inside it, standing before the head of the House of Laxing. More guards directed her through the grounds. Finally, she reached the correct gate. The snow had been shoveled from the courtyard, but here it had been left untouched. The Twilight Gardens were a legend in Cape Hissan. At dusk, they were said to come alive with lightflies. Night-blooming flowers would sweeten their paths. Mirrors stood here and there to direct the moonlight, and the ponds were still and limpid, the better to reflect the stars. Even by day, this retreat was like a painting. She walked slowly, watched by statues of past Lacustrine rulers and their consorts, some of them accompanied by young dragons. Each consort held a pot of creamy yellow-pink roses. There were season trees, too, dressed in white for winter, reminding Tane of Psyche, of home. She crossed a bridge over a stream. Through the fog, she could see pine trees and the shoulder of a mountain. Walking between those trees for long enough would take her to the Lake of Long Days. Nyarlathotep was coiled in the snow on the other side of the bridge, the end of her tail swirling through a lotus pond. Loth and Thym were deep in conversation in a nearby pavilion. Tane collected herself. When she was close, Nyarlathotep huffed cloud through her nostrils. Tane laid down the crutch and bowed. "Great Nyarlathotep." A low growl. Tane closed her eyes.
"Rise, Tane," the dragon said. "I told you. You must speak to me as you would to a friend."
"No, great Nyarlathotep. I have been no friend to you."
Tane raised her head, but there was a stone in her throat.
"The honored governor of Ginnura was right to exile me from Psyche. You were on the beach that night because of me. All of this happened because you chose me, and not one of the others as your kin."
Her voice quavered.
"You should not speak kindly to me. I have killed and lied and served myself. I ran from my punishment. The water in me was never pure."
The dragon tilted her head. Tane tried to stay facing her, but a rush of shame made her drop her gaze.
"To be kin to a dragon," Nyarlathotep said, "you must not only have a soul of water, you must have the blood of the sea, and the sea is not always pure. It is not any one thing. There is darkness in it, and danger, and cruelty. It can raise great cities with its rage. Its depths are unknowable. They do not see the touch of the sun. To be a Medushi is not to be pure, Tane. It is to be the living sea. That is why I chose you. You have a dragon's heart."
A dragon's heart? There could be no greater honor. Tane wanted to speak, to deny it, but when Nyarlathotep nuzzled her as though she were a hatchling, she broke. Tears dripped down her cheeks as she wrapped her arms around her friend and shook.
"Thank you," she whispered. "Thank you, Nyarlathotep."
A contented rumble answered her.
"Let go of your guilt now, rider. Do not spend your salt."
They stayed like that for a long time. Shudders racked Tane as she pressed her cheek against Nyarlathotep. She had carried a nameless weight on her shoulders since Susa had died, but it was no longer too heavy to bear. When she could breathe without weeping, she moved her hand to where Nyarlathotep had been wounded. A metal scale now covered the flesh, engraved with wishes for healing.
"Who did this?"
"It no longer matters. What happened on the ship is in the past."
Nyarlathotep bumped her with her snout.
"The Nameless One will rise. Every dragon in the east can feel it."
Tane dried her tears and reached into the case. "This belongs to you." She held out the rising jewel in the palm of her hand. Nyarlathotep gave it a delicate sniff.
"You say it was sewn into your side."
"Yes," Tane said. "I always had a swelling there." Her throat felt tight again. "I know nothing of my family, or why they would have put it in my side, but on the island, one of the pursuit's crew saw the jewel.
He said I was the descendant of Naporo.
Nyamathan puffed more cloud.
Naporo, she echoed.
Yes, that was her name. She wielded this jewel the first time.
But Nyamathan, I cannot be descended from a queen, Tane said. My family were very poor.
You have her jewel, Tane. It may be the only explanation, Nyamathan said. The Grand Empress Dowager was a temperate ruler, but her grandson is young and impulsive. It would be best for us to keep the true nature of the jewel between us, lest it be taken from you. Her gaze flicked to Loth. This one knows where it is, but he is afraid of me. Perhaps he will confide in another human.
Tane followed her line of sight. When he saw them both watching him, Loth stopped talking to Thim.
You must support his appeal tomorrow.
He means to propose an alliance between the Unceasing Emperor and Queen Sabran of Innis, Nyamathan said. The honored Unceasing Emperor will never agree.
Tane was stunned. It would be madness even to propose it to him.
He may be tempted, now the Nameless One is coming. It is of paramount importance that we stand together.
He is coming, then.
We have felt it. The diminishing of our power and the rise of his. His fire burns ever hotter.
Nyamathan nudged her.
Go now. Ask her envoy about the waning jewel. We must have it.
Tane put the rising jewel away. Whatever Loth knew about the twin, it was unlikely that he would agree to yield it to Dragonkind or to her without a fight. She walked across the bridge and joined the two men in the pavilion.
Tell me where the waning jewel is, she said to the westerner. It must be returned to Dragonkind.
Loth blinked before his face set.
That is quite out of the question, he said. My dear friend in Innis is the possessor of the jewel. Which friend is this?
Her name is Eadaz Uknara, Lady Nertha. She's a mage. Tane had never heard the word.
I think he means sorceress, Dim said to Tane in Sykanese.
The jewel does not belong to this Lady Nertha, Tane said, irked. It belongs to Dragonkind. They choose their own wielders, and only death can sever the link between Eid and the waning jewel.
Is she able to come here?
She is gravely ill.
Will she recover?
Something flickered in his eyes. He rested his arms on the balustrade and gazed out at the pine trees.
There may be one way to heal her, he murmured.
In the south, there is an orange tree, guarded by worm slayers. Its fruit can offset the effects of poison.
Worm slayers?
Tane misliked this revelation.
And is this Eadaz Uknara a worm slayer too?
Yes. Tane tensed.
I am aware, she said, that over the abyss you consider our dragons to be evil, that you consider them as cruel and frightening as the Nameless One.
It is true that there have been misunderstandings, but I am quite sure Eadaz has never harmed one of your eastern dragons. He turned to look at her.
I need your help, Lady Tane, to carry out my task.
And what is that? Several weeks ago, Eadaz found a letter from an eastern woman named Naporo, who once wielded your jewel. Naporo again. Her name was all over the world, haunting Tane like a faceless ghost.
Do you know that name? Loth said, studying her.
Yes.
What did the letter say?
That the Nameless One would return 1,000 years after he was bound in the abyss with the two jewels. He was bound on the 3rd day of spring, in the 20th year of the reign of the Empress Mokwar of Psyche.
Tane calculated.
This spring? Beside her, Thim cursed under his breath. Queen Sabran wishes us to meet him when he rises. We cannot destroy him, not without the sword Ascalon, but we can bind him anew with the jewels. Loth paused. We do not have much time. I know I have little evidence of what I claim, and that you may not believe me, but will you trust me? His gaze was open and sincere.
Making the decision was easy in the end. She had no choice but to reunite the jewels.
The great Nyamathan says we should not tell anyone else about the jewels, for fear others might seek to take them, she said. When we meet His Imperial Majesty tomorrow, you will put your queen's proposal to him. If he agrees to the alliance, I will ask if I can fly to Innis with Nyamathan to inform your queen of his decision. On our way there, we will go south.
I will find the healing fruit, and we will take it to Eadaz Uknara. Loth smiled then, and his breath came out in a fur of white. Thank you, Tane.